is Kim Buchanan. It's September 30th on Wednesday.
And it's a tour of the museum.
Yes. I really am surprised. There are like three times as many people here today as were here yesterday.
I know.
We'll start here at the beginning. The game plan generally is I will talk to you for 25 or 30 minutes and then let you all explore. And as you have questions, feel free to ask me, and I'll just kind of wander around after that point. If you have any questions as we're going through, please be sure to ask those. And most of what, well, a lot of what you will see here will correspond to what you've read in BOAT, hopefully what you've read in BOAT, or will have read in BOAT by tomorrow. So let's just get started, and I'll try to speak as loud as I can so that you all can hear. If you can't, just raise your hand and I'll try to up the volume there.
What? How'd you say?
The first two cases house some very old Bibles. These belong to Dr. Drinkard, and they're from either the 16th or the 17th century. We have a very old, the first one down there is an old King James version of the Bible. You might like to see what the print looks like, the old print. And in some of the older Bibles, you'll notice the fluidity of the spelling. Sometimes the same word will not be spelled the same way any two or three times. So you might like to, just on your own, come and look at these and try to read some of the passages that are here. I'd also like to make mention of the Haldeman collection of Bibles that we have in the library. It's that first room on the right as you walk into the library. And anytime you want, you can get the key from the desk and go in and explore those Bibles for yourselves. And they really are kind of fascinating. There are other artifacts in there related to the seminary and its history, so you might find that kind of interesting. The next few cases here on the right have just various textiles and other artifacts, coins, and a lot of these are Coptic, which Coptic is kind of the written language was Egyptian hieroglyphics put into Greek characters. And you all may do someday if you want to do a dissertation in the area of New Testament, you might do something with Coptic kinds of things. We have a lot of inscriptions that are Coptic, and you might like to explore some of those. On the left, in the upright cases, roughly this side has to do with the Roman era, which is when Jesus and Paul were living, and down on the other end, it's more like the first couple of centuries of the church. So you have Caesarea Maritima in the case down at the very end, the blue-backed case. That's really interesting. Let me see if I can... Now, if you'll remember your geography, Middle Eastern geography, Israel is the country that's on the north. It's on a north-south boundary with the Mediterranean Sea. Well, on that piece of land there really isn't a good port from the Mediterranean Sea. So Herod, you've heard of Herod and all of his great building endeavors, one of his projects was to build a port into the Mediterranean Sea, which he did at Caesarea Maritima. And you have kind of an artist's rendering here in this picture of what that port would have been like. He poured, I don't know if it was concrete or what, but poured it right out into the sea. And we were there this summer and had lunch right in what would have been that building that you see right there on the sea. And it really is fascinating and just mind-boggling to think of how they could build this. They're still doing excavations. In fact, as we were eating lunch, I saw some scuba divers coming up with artifacts that they had unearthed down in the water. And if you ever get a chance to see some pictures of Caesarea Maritima in books or articles, I would encourage you to do that. It's just beautiful. It really is beautiful. So this is roughly first couple of centuries of the church, and then the Roman period with Paul. And you can kind of, perhaps when you break up a little bit later, come and see some of the lamps, the mosaic. We have a piece of a floor that's done in mosaics, and also some coins you might like to look at a little bit later. We do have a scroll here, an old Hebrew scroll, but this is probably about 150 years old. It's not quite as old as some of the other things that we have in the museum. For those of you who have had Hebrew or who are in Hebrew, you might like to read through some of this. It doesn't have the vowel pointings. People are laughing. I don't know why. It doesn't have the vowel pointings and all of that, but it is from one of the first couple of chapters of Genesis. So you might like a chance to look through that a little bit later on. And y'all might like to come on and spill over into this other area, because we have several things to see here, and it might be easier for people in the back to hear. Y'all might like to spill on back, too, if we... Next time I'm splitting it down the middle, this side and that side. That's... Okay, the piece that we have on the wall is called the Moabite Stone. And if you've read in Boat, he gives the text for the Moabite Stone. It's dated about 9th century BCE, and it tells of the conquest of Mesha, king of Moab. Now, Moab is in what is today probably roughly central Jordan. You know, you've got Israel, you've got the Jordan Valley and the Jordan River, and then you've got Jordan, the country of Jordan. And it's roughly central Jordan is what we equate with Moab. Let me read to you part of the text that Boat has in his book. Omri, king of Israel, humbled Moab many days for Chemosh, that was the Moabite god. Chemosh was angry at his land, but Chemosh restored it in my days. And Chemosh said to me, this is Mesha speaking, go take Nebo from Israel. And I went by night and fought against it from the break of dawn until noon, taking and slaying all, 7,000 men, boys, women, girls, and even maidservants, for I had devoted them to destruction for the god Ishtar Chemosh. So this is important because it is an extra biblical reference to Israel, which there aren't a whole lot of those. So for that fact, it's important. Also, the similarity in that passage and some other passages in the Old Testament where an entire city would be obliterated as a devotion, a dedication to God or to Yahweh. So the similarities in the language is very significant, as well as the extra biblical reference to Israel. Now, in 2 Kings chapter 3, there is a Mesha, king of Moab, mentioned. And let me read to you just a few verses from chapter 3 of 2 Kings, starting in verse 4. Now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder and used to pay the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it came about when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. And King Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time and mustered all Israel. Then he went and sent word to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, saying, the king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? And he said, I will go up. I am as you are. My people is your people. My horses is your horses. And later on in verse 21, all the kings have gathered together. And it says, now all the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them. And all who were able to put on armor and older were summoned and stood on the border. And they rose early in the morning, and the sun shone on the water, and the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. Then they said, this is blood. The kings have surely fought together, and they have slain one another. Now therefore, Moab, to the spoil. But when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites arose and struck the Moabites, so that they fled before them, and they went forward into the land, slaughtering the Moabites. Thus they destroyed the cities, and each one threw a stone on every piece of good land and filled it. So they stopped all the springs of water and felled all the good trees until in Kir Hareseth, only they left its stones. However, the slingers went about it and struck it. When the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took with him 700 men who drew swords to break through the king of Edom, but they could not. This is what we usually remember about Mesha. Then he took the oldest son who was to reign in his place and offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. And there came great wrath against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. That's usually what we remember about Mesha, is he's the one who sacrificed his son on the wall. But you can see in the biblical text a reference to Mesha, and on the Mesha stone, a reference to Israel. So that's kind of fascinating. The story behind this artifact itself is very fascinating. Of course, this is a replica of the real thing, but an archaeologist in the late 19th century discovered the Moabite stone, and he had to purchase it from some Bedouins who were there, who are people who like are nomads and dwell in tents and that kind of thing. And the Bedouins thought, well, this is really neat. I mean, this must be very valuable if this person wants this thing. And so what they did while he was gone, he had made an impression, first of all, of the inscription, kind of like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you saw where he would make the squeeze and put it in his pocket, or the rubbing. Well, he had done one of those. But while he was gone, the Bedouins heated it up, got it really hot, and then poured cold water on it so that either they could get the treasure that they thought must be inside it, or so that they could have a lot of different pieces of it to sell or whatever. So that part of the story is kind of interesting. And the part that's kind of grainy, that's what was left. That's the original. The really clear part was made from the frieze, or the squeeze, rather, that he made. So that's kind of interesting. Now, two things that we'll need to look at. One is, in this case, it's called the Siloam inscription. And the other is on the outside of this little piece of wall here. And you might like to just kind of get us all over in this direction so that you all can see the Lachish inscription and then also the Siloam inscription. And you may come back a little later and look at it on your own. Okay, let me read to you again from 2 Kings, this time from chapter 18. And these are the things you need to listen for: Lachish and Hezekiah. Listen for those two things. Beginning in chapter 18, verse 13. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Okay, that kind of sets the picture. Lachish, if you read in Boat, was the second most important city in Judah. And at this point, Sennacherib, who's the Assyrian king, has conquered Lachish and has set up camp there, is apparently what it sounds like. And Jerusalem is the last city to be conquered. Okay, and Hezekiah saying, I've done it wrong, you know, let's talk about this. If you all were in chapel a couple of weeks ago when Dr. Lascalzo preached, this is the same chapter that he preached from, when the Sennacherib's envoy went up to the wall and was speaking in Hebrew, and the people said, speak in Aramaic and all that. So that'll kind of give you a context for where this is coming from. Okay, let me pick up again in chapter 19, verses 35 and 36. Sennacherib didn't take Jerusalem. Okay, and it says here in verse 35, then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. So Sennacherib did not conquer Jerusalem while Hezekiah was there. Now the six panels that we have, three on this side and then three around on the other side, they're replicas of panels that were found in Sennacherib's throne room. This is kind of the history book, the court history of the capture of Lachish. And there are a lot of things that you can tell about ancient warfare by looking at these panels. First of all, you can see some of the weaponry that was used. You can see the torches coming down and the rocks coming down. You can also see probably the most memorable part of this whole thing are the Israelites that are impaled, or the citizens of Lachish impaled on sticks, stripped and impaled, as a reminder to all who would pass of the power of the Assyrians. Also, you see the women and children being escorted out, perhaps to become slaves. And you can see the Assyrian headdress here for the soldiers that are coming up. There are also some other kinds of headdress, which I don't know what those are. But on the other side, the soldiers are bigger, and you can get a bigger feel, a better feel for what their outfits and gear looked like. Now, the Siloam inscription, why? Why did Sennacherib conquer all of Judah and not Jerusalem? Well, part of it was some of Hezekiah's fancy footwork, but also it had to do with the tunnel, Hezekiah's tunnel. And let me read just quickly 20:20 out of 2 Kings. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? Well, let's see. 2 Chronicles 32:30. It was Hezekiah who stopped the upper outlet of the waters of Gihon and directed them to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all that he did. Now, what is this water system that he talked about? How many of you have read Michener and the Psalm of the Hoopoe Bird? Okay, that is essentially what Hezekiah sponsored in Jerusalem. Ancient cities were built on hills. Why do you think that would be? Okay, for defense. You know, if your enemies are coming, you can see them coming. That's the same reason why they would build a wall around, for protection, you know. Now, if you see your enemies coming, you want to put the gate up because you don't want them to come in, which is good, except where are the water sources? Are the water sources up on hills? No, not if gravity is in working order, which we hope it is. Water is found in the lower places. So if you've got your water source in the lower places, it's going to be outside the city. So when you close up the gate, when the enemies are coming, you're not going to have access to your water. And so a process that the ancients devised was this building a tunnel under the wall so that the water source wouldn't be cut off in case of attack. So that is part of the reason that Jerusalem survived the attack. And I was so glad that, what's his name, Boat, had, sorry, the most right Reverend Boat, or actually I think he's a, well, okay, let me read part of the inscription that you will find in there, but this is an old Hebrew and I can't read this, so. And this will sound familiar to Michener, for those of you who have read Michener. While there were still 3 cubits to be cut, there was heard the voice of a man calling to his fellow. And when the tunnel was driven through, the workers hewed the rock, man to man, axe against axe, and the water gushed from the spring toward the reservoir, 1,200 cubits away. And so they started, you know, one group on one end, one group on the other end, and they just tunneled and tunneled and tunneled and finally met in the middle. And I still don't know how that happened. But I think Michener's account of that is really fascinating. And he did actually work with, I don't know what Dr. Tate has told you all, he actually worked with, I think it was Yigdol Yadin, and I'm not sure what sites, it may have been Hatzor or Gezer, but he actually worked with archaeologists talking with them about the process. And I reread some of Michener this summer after I came back from the Middle East, and had visited some sites and some tells there, and it really is very accurate, the kinds of things that he's writing about, especially the process of archaeology and all of that. So read Michener with open eyes, because he really does know what he's talking about. All right, let's move on around this way. Tell you what, let's spill over into this area. It's kind of hard to see with so many folks, so I'll just kind of tell you what's here, and you all can come back and look a little later. You all probably have noticed that the name of the museum is the Joseph A. Calloway Museum. Dr. Calloway was an archaeology and Old Testament professor here for several years, and he also was an archaeologist, did several digs in the Middle East. Now, he was the head excavator at Ai, and so a lot of the smaller artifacts that we have that are authentic were acquired by Dr. Calloway when he was doing his digs. The first case over there, it's called The Archaeologist at Work, and I would encourage you to go sometime and read some of the copy that's in the case, and it will give you a little synopsis of what it means to do archaeology. Also, there are three students who went and actually participated in digs this summer that are graduate students here at Southern. One is Jack Painter. He's in New Testament. Mike O'Neill is in Old Testament, and Edward Bolin is in New Testament. And you might like to talk with them some. In fact, Jack Painter was at Caesarea Maritima, where they're doing the underwater excavation. He didn't do the underwater, but he was there at that place. So you all might like to talk with them at some point about that process as well. I'll just let you all look in this area on your own. Let's go on through and meet our pride and joy. Tell you what, I'm going to go out this way. Be claustrophobic. Understand. You know, every place we went in the Middle East, it was like this little hole under a church. I was like, I don't want to do this. Take me to Mount Sinai where I can see this. Sherry has an interesting story. I'm sure she had an interesting story before the late 1800s, but that's where I'll pick it up today. She was purchased by someone, I don't know who, in Egypt in the 1890s. And by 1906, she had made her way to the States and was donated to the seminary. Now, at that point, it was still a closed sarcophagus. And people assumed that there wasn't anything in it, that it was just an empty Egyptian sarcophagus. And so she was just in storage in professors' offices. At one point, they said she was in a room by the cafeteria. Of course. So in 1960-61, when Dr. Calloway started the museum, they decided to get into the mummy to see if there was anything in there, and they opened it up, and there she was. And she's a very well-preserved mummy. When you come by, if you'd like to look a little closer, her head, of course, was wrapped up when they found her, but they unwrapped that, and the skin that's on her head, that's original teeth, the ones that are still there. In this region, she is one of the best preserved mummies that exists. She's gone on several journeys. She's been down to Memphis when they had the Ramses exhibit several years back, and she also has been downtown to our museum there. She's also been to the hospital a couple of times, and she's had a CAT scan done. And when you get a chance, you might like to look at the CAT scan, and there's some copy there that you might like to read as well. There is a story when they took her down to, one of the hospitals downtown, I can't remember which one. They had taken her out of the case and had laid her, I think they had taken her out of the case. I'm not sure. But anyway, they had laid her on the table to do the x-rays, and they'd done one set, and then they were going to turn the machine and do another set. And as they did that, the table shook, and one of Sherry's feet went this way, one went this way, and two technicians went this way and out of the room. And so if you don't want to look too close, but if you do, you'll see that her feet are super glued in. But anyway.
Super what?
Super glued. Because her feet weren't real stable. In fact, I think one of them they put back on backwards. Because we saw the x-rays, and they're like, she has two left feet. I don't know. Maybe she just had two left feet. They date her about 700 or so B.C., which makes her late in the mummification process, which is one of the reasons why she's so well-preserved. So they think guessing from her x-rays that she was maybe in her 50s, 60s when she died, which meant that she was pretty old. They somehow determined that she had given birth. And to be mummified in this way means that she probably was upper middle class in what we would call that, at least. So. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure if it doesn't say what kind of wood it is on there. I don't know. That's a good question. The hieroglyphs, too, I don't know that we have a translation for. So if anybody does a dissertation in Egyptian hieroglyphs, please come back and translate Sherry for us. There are some objects inside her, and you can see that in some of the, probably in the top CAT scan here of the chest. You can see some of the objects that are inside her. Of course, they would take the organs out and mummify them separately. And so it may be that, or it may be a Ushabti, which, excuse me just a minute, you'll see right over here on the right side of this case when you get a chance, they're like little Egyptian dolls. And the Ushabti would be the person or the being who would either serve the person in the afterlife or take the punishment for the person in the afterlife if they've been bad in this life. So it may be that, or it may be rolled up portions of the Book of the Dead that are inside her. Of course, they can't go inside to get all that stuff without destroying the mummy itself, so they won't do that. So we can only speculate about what that is. So do you all have any questions about? I don't know that I can answer them, but we could try. You've heard about the Rosetta Stone. I'd heard about the Rosetta Stone all my life and didn't know anything about it until I had to teach a lesson on it, so thought I better learn something. And it's also, I think it's in Boat. The significance of the Rosetta Stone has to do with Egyptian hieroglyphics. For centuries, scholars didn't know how to translate or decipher the hieroglyphs that they had found. And it was 1798 or 1799, Napoleon's people were in northern Africa and stumbled onto this artifact. It has Greek at the bottom, which of course everybody could read, and then it has a second language in the middle, which is Demotic, which is like a very late script form of hieroglyphs, and then the top part are the hieroglyphs themselves. And the way that they were able to decipher the hieroglyphs is they could, of course, translate the Greek, and they saw the name of Ptolemy in the Greek. And in the hieroglyphs, they saw that some of the figures, some of the pictures, were circled. And that was called a cartouche. That is called a cartouche. That's what they named it. Now, a cartouche is like on the wall here. You see there are lots of different symbols, but there's some that have a circle around it with the bottom. That's a cartouche, and it can either go up and down or it can go sideways. It doesn't matter with hieroglyphs. But they figured out that what was in a cartouche was a foreign name, and it was transliterated. It's like if we were writing a letter to someone and we were to talk about our friend who is a Korean, and we wanted to transliterate that, and we would circle it. It's kind of the same thing of what they were doing. And so because of that, Jean-François Champollion in 1820 somewhere finally cracked the code, and they were able to decipher the hieroglyphs. So that's the importance of the Rosetta Stone, if you ever have wondered about that, which I did all my life. So now you know the rest of the story. Okay, just a couple of more things. Some of you may be wondering, but how am I going to use this for a paper? And you still may be wondering that when we get done today. One possible kind of paper, and this may be later on when you're doing your PhD work in Old Testament. This is the Hammurabi Stone, or the Code of Hammurabi, which also you may have heard about at some point. And it dates from, what's it say on there,
1750 B.C.
Okay, 1750 B.C., the 18th century B.C. And this is a law code. written in the cuneiform. And the significance of this, and if you'll come by later and read the copy that's on the board there, there is a lot of similarity between the law codes of Hammurabi and some of the law codes that we find in the Pentateuch. And so doing a comparison there might be kind of interesting. Of course, the law codes that come in the Pentateuch are much later than this, but you might enjoy seeing what some of the comparisons are. The other obelisk kind of thing that we have is the black obelisk. And of course, these are replicas of the real stuff. This is kind of like the Meshes Stela. It belonged to Shalmaneser, and it tells about the time when Jehu, the Israelite king, or he may have been a Judean king, I can't remember. Anyway, look it up in your Bibles in 2 Kings 9 and 10, and you'll find out about Jehu. He was paying homage to Shalmaneser, and you'll see all of the gifts that he brought. He brought camels, all kinds of animals, around the back there, elephants, and then, of course, in text, also what was brought in the tribute to Shalmaneser. Another thing that might be interesting for you as far as papers goes, you read about perhaps in, or you may have talked about in class, the Enuma Elish, which is a creation epic, Babylonian creation epic, and we have a replica of that text, that inscription, right in here. And it is actual size. It's about this big. You all see it when you come up. It's very, very small. But it's written in cuneiform, which this whole line of cases talks about the development of cuneiform, which is basically wedge-shaped writing. And they would write it with a stylus and print it in clay and print the figures in clay. And you can see all of these artifacts have that kind of writing on it. So you might like to look at these when you come by. There's also a copy of the the Sumerian flood epic. And you've heard, I'm sure, about the different cultures that have different creation and different flood epics, just like the Israelites had their own stories about creation and the flood. So you might like to do a comparison of that at some point. Just a couple of things finally. Oh, I forgot to talk about these cases. These cases basically are just before the Roman period and the Roman period. And when we're talking about the Roman period, that's like the time of Jesus. Just think time of Jesus. Basically, I don't know where Nehemiah came in there. So you might like to just look at those on your own and see, some coins and other artifacts from those that era. Last two things. When I had Dr. Drinkard's archaeology class a couple of years ago, we were like halfway through the semester, and I thought, you know, he's been talking about pottery for a long time now. What's the deal about pottery? And if you've read Boat, you know that pottery is very, very significant for dating sites, because pottery, once it's fired, just lasts and lasts and lasts. And so by looking at both the design on the pottery and the way that it was fired and all of that, you can kind of roughly date a site or a level in a site. And here, of course, lamps are made out of pottery, and so that kind of gets us into this. But this is a basic gradual development of lamps that you have perhaps seen before. The bottom are the older, up to the more sophisticated at the top. And you might like just to come and read some of the inscriptions that have been translated here on your own. The last, we have just a brief collection here of examples of writing. Boat also mentions ostraca, which it's kind of like letters that were written on potsherds, on broken pieces of pottery, and they would just write on them with ink. And we have a couple of examples of those that you might like to come and look at, as well as some papyrus inscriptions as well. So that's my spiel, and I'll let you just kind of wander around, and if you have other questions, please feel free to come and ask. And if I don't see you, good luck tomorrow.
Is it going to tell you about between 20s and quarter?
Yeah, that's fine.
Because the chapel choir singing today.
Yeah, okay. You're free as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Well, I still want to. I've been here before, but I thought getting the chapel from here is worse than
getting
from
the chapel. Well, there was someone yesterday who was singing, so it's no problem.
Not that I have test anxiety or anything, but Dr. Tate did mention that we'd see specific digs, and I realize these are different places. Is this all we need to know about?
I don't know. I haven't graded for him. I'm trying to think if he talked about sites.
Because he mentioned we'd need to know 5 sites, and there are plenty of them in here.
You've got
some of them circled. Yes. But they don't, in Boat, it tells, this dig, it didn't tell who dug it or what they found, really. I was thinking, he's probably going to want a little more meat to this than, there's these 5 names, and, this one was big,
Yeah. Now, I don't know.
He seemed to think that between Boat and between the museum, we'd have all the information we needed.
Okay. Well, he did not talk to me about, he may have assumed that I would tell you all about particular sites, which...
But this is being taped, so he'll have his tape?
Yes.
He'll know that we're having this conversation, but that's still on.
Actually, yes, I can turn it off. Why don't you talk with him today and see what he thinks? And if I see him, I may mention something to him. But I mean, he didn't ask me to do that. But I'm not his grader. I don't know how he tests or anything. So.
Did we get the Picastorian Missionary?
See, I don't know. All I know is what he told me.
Better be checking it out.
Yeah.
Y'all may just like to go